Welcome on, Senior.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 4 of volume 2. We're moving along already.
We are. It's not happy material.
It is not happy material. We did not have fun last week.
Guess what? It's going to get worse.
Oh, can't. I didn't think that was possible.
Oh, yeah. We're going to add pestilence to this time.
Oh.
But toward the end.
Okay. You're right. I do remember that time period should be coming up.
Yeah. We were talking about the nativists. Their fear of the Catholic Church, the thought that they had was that the Catholics had some kind of a plot in order to invade America by immigrants, German and Irish immigrants coming in. They forget the fact that half of the Germans coming were Protestants. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of funny. But anyway, they see all of these people coming in and many of them joining the Democratic Party rather than the Whig Party. It looks like they're thinking in terms of a takeover of the Democratic Party by these foreigners, and then so many Catholic institutions, property that's being bought up for churches, for schools, for universities, for hospitals. They're seeing that. They're seeing Catholic farmers. And we've seen already so many of the German immigrants coming to rural America, populating little villages that had been founded by Americans and now become German villages. And so they just see in all of this some kind of a takeover that's happening.
Is there any evidence that they really felt that way, or is it that they're what they're just hyping up?
No.
I suppose that would be hard to tell.
Oh, no. They're definitely feeling
it. They really believe that.
Yeah, because I'm going to tell you about some of the violent acts that they took in order to play this out. So,
okay.
No, this is just not
rhetoric. So
this
is not just rhetoric. Political. It's right.
Yeah, it's very heartfelt. They also saw the money that was coming to America by way of the Society for the Propagation of the Faith, the Leopoldine Society. They don't see this as money that's going to support Catholics in assimilating into American society or even for catechesis or evangelization. They see this as foreign money, Catholic money, that's coming from Catholic monarchs, that's coming into American culture to influence American culture and ultimately to take over America. So who are some of these people? Samuel F.B. Morris, the inventor of the Morse code. He is a very well-known man, very outspoken in all of this. Lyman Beecher is a preacher and a Protestant minister. We know him mainly through Harriet Beecher Stowe, Next Generation. Elijah Lovejoy, we've already seen a little bit about him. We're going to see more about him. And then the Reverend Robert Baird was another one. Now, these men all took the high ground approach of preaching and that sort of thing. There are two others that literally devolve into near pornographic books. You know, pornography was not acceptable back in those days. But if you could couch it in the terms of Catholics,
prejudice,
you can get away with it. One of those was written by Rebecca Reed. Her book is entitled 6 Months in a Convent. So it's a tell-all book, you know. And then another one, which is even worse, was Maria Monk. And her book was called Awful Disclosure of the Hotel Dieu Nunnery, supposedly that takes place in Canada. All of this, it is put into the cauldron of the election of 1844, which I mentioned last time around. Elections were very riotous affairs. Remember that at this time you did not have the Australian ballot, the secret ballot, so everybody knew how everybody voted. At the ballot box itself, there would be scuffles that took place.
I was going to say, if this much tension, that has to be a pretty violent affair.
Yeah, I mean, during this election, you have a mob of 3,000 people, 3,000 St. Louisans, attacked St. Louis University's medical school. And they got in, they destroyed the laboratories, they destroyed furniture, and ultimately had to close down the medical school for several years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I can't explain that when people get in that mob mentality how there's obviously no thinking going on that you would consider at this time
a medical
period.
School.
Right.
Yeah.
Tearing apart a medical school.
Yeah.
Who's only going to be helping you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, what happens is that you've got all the bigotry, mm-hmm. all the anti-Catholicism, you've got some demagogues that are leading this, and then added to that, there's also this rumor that's circulating about body snatching out of cemeteries to do experiments in the medical schools. That's, again, one reason why the medical school was attacked. After they did that, then somebody said, well, what about WashU's medical school? They started moving in that direction. Well, they put a kibosh on that right away. They were just going after Catholics. Uh-huh. Pardon me. Yeah. So you have that. There is definitely attempts to keep the foreign-born away from the voting polls. In the summer of 1844, there are a number of churches that are torched, that are burned down in Philadelphia, which is, of course, Peter Richard Kenrick's brother's see, Francis Patrick. St. Michael's Church, the diocesan seminary was destroyed, St. Augustine's Church, and along with that, the library at St. Augustine's, a 5,000-volume library, was burned up. And along with that, some 30 Catholic homes.
This is in Philadelphia?
Yeah. You're going to have other instances in Boston, in New York. New York is a famous one where Bishop Hughes found out that there was a mob coming to burn down St. Patrick's, and he got some Irishmen with muskets and a small cannon and confronted the mob, and they walked away. He then went to the mayor and said to the mayor that, you know, where was the police department? We didn't see any police. And the mayor goes, oh, well, this thing happens. We can't control everything. And Bishop Hughes is reported to have said to the mayor, if one of my churches is burned down, New York City is going to look like Moscow. Now, not too many years earlier, if you remember, during the Napoleonic invasion, the city of Moscow was burned to the cinders. Everything was burned. The mayor started providing police protection after that. Bishop Hughes was not somebody to trifle
with.
You don't
take lightly.
On May 29th of 1849 is a really rough time in St. Louis. You're going to have riots. You're going to have the major fire that's of 1849. Mm-hmm. You also have a cholera outbreak. We're going to go back a little bit later on and talk about earlier cholera outbreaks, but this was really rough. But on May 29th, there was an anti-Irish riot that erupted. What had happened was that there was a fire that broke out by the riverfront among several steamboats. And this is just literally weeks after the Great Fire of 1849. That was on May 17th. Now this one breaks out
really
on May
close.
28th. So a lot of the volunteer firefighters companies went out to put this fire out. And while they were fighting the fire, some lone Irishman, it's impossible to understand, started taunting them. Does this make any sense? Of course not. So some of the firefighters left the fire and went over and began beating this man up. Well, there are a whole bunch of Irishmen who are working on these boats, and they leave the boats to go and defend.
Get in the fight.
Before you know it, they're not just throwing fists. They're also throwing stones at each other. The police intervene. They arrested the ringleaders on both sides. But in the end, it didn't help because the mobs weren't dispersed. And so as soon as they were gone, boom, they got right at it again. Now, by this time, the nativists had heard about this, and they came in great numbers. And so the Irish didn't have a chance. And so they fled to the shelter of O'Brien's Saloon. And that comes under attack. People are storming that. And then they went from one to another. Ultimately, they went to four Irish establishments, and each one of them was destroyed by these mobs. Eventually, the police came back, and they were supplemented by some 50 volunteers. Even then, later on in the evening, the nativists came back again to start more fights on this area called Battle Row. This time around, they even brought with them a 6-inch howitzer, a cannon.
Wow.
Yeah. The police then had to come back again, and eventually they captured the gun, which had been hidden in the Missouri Volunteer Firehouse.
Oh my
so God. That says something about what's going on with all of that. In 1850, it was the Germans' turn to feel nativist fury. On election day, rumors had spread that the Germans had taken over one of the voting polls in the first ward that's down in the south, and a Whig mob then went down to the first ward to make sure that wasn't happening, and fistfights broke out. Eventually, the crowd, the nativists, actually closed down the voting poll so that the Germans couldn't vote. and they threatened to burn down the German houses that were there. So the Germans then went up on the roof of their houses with guns and began shooting at the mob, which returned fire. And one of the houses, in fact, was torched before the nativist mob left. The fact of the matter is that violence was true about many cities, but violence had come to St. Louis. It was no longer the lovely little Creole village that it had been. It's now got some real issues that are going on. Ready for pestilence?
Okay.
Okay. We're going to go back to 1832. The 1849 epidemic was actually a later one. So if we go back to 1832, St. Louis, for the first time, experiences a disease that it had not known before. What's happening is that several people ended up with a bad case of diarrhea, stomach cramps, vomiting. All of this led to massive dehydration, which would lead then to organ failure with a collapse of the circulatory system. As I say, they didn't know exactly what was causing this, but all the symptoms were the same. Most of the people died between October 14th and October 25th. So an 11-day period. On one day, October 23rd, 30 people died in St. Louis of this same thing. Even two of the doctors who were treating the sick succumbed to the disease, got it, and died. The Sisters of Charity were taking care of the victims, too. One young nun died also while ministering. It's not until you get the first frost and winter comes that the disease began to break away. This is St. Louis's first experience of cholera. Various steps were taken to defend the population. None of them were very effective. For one thing, the city was cleansed. People all over the city just cleaned the city. Pork sales were limited because they thought maybe pork had something to do with it.
At that point, I'm sure you try anything.
Try anything, yeah. People were advised to wash their vegetables and their fruit in fresh water. Okay.
There's a key right there.
Yeah, although it's not, and I'll explain why in a minute.
Okay.
The sick were bled, which, of course, did more harm than good. People complained of stagnant and fetid waters. Well, that's true. Choteau's Pond at this time is told to be dried up. There's also up on the north part of the city, there was a big sinkhole up there. It had all kinds of stagnant water in it. The people in the area called it Kaiser's Lake, named after the city engineer, because he didn't seem to be able to do anything about it. None of this actually was effective against the disease. And the reason is that cholera is spread by fecal matter and of those who are infected by it. Now, it could be transmitted by contaminated water, and that's why unless you're using fresh water on your vegetables, you could actually be contaminating yourself. But the other thing to keep in mind is that this disease is spread by houseflies,
and cockroaches.
And so if you go ahead and, you know, wash your vegetables and fruit in clean water and it's sitting out and some housefly flies around and lands on it, boom, you can get infected by that. This is actually the second epidemic of cholera.
1832 is the second.
The first one was in 1817, but it never got to St. Louis.
Okay.
And it was started in, of all places, Calcutta, India, which has been the home of a lot of diseases.
Right.
It spread very rapidly. The first one, 1817, is the first modern recorded experience of cholera, spread very rapidly throughout all of South Asia, Southeast Asia, Singapore, and even jumped to the islands of Java and Borneo. You know, that's really something. And then it went west. It struck the Middle East, all the way into Palestine, then north, all the way into southern Russia, causing 2 million deaths. The 1832 actually started in 1826, again in India. By 1827, 1 year later, it was appearing in Russia. And then from there, it was carried by Russian soldiers going into Poland to suppress a Polish uprising. And so from Poland then, it spread to Germany, to Austria, to Hungary. By 1832, there were cases reported in Paris. The Parisians attempted to combat the disease with a hygiene campaign in the city itself, which was unsuccessful because the Parisian mobs, the day workers and day laborers, thought that this was some kind of an act on the part of the government to suppress them. And so they actually thwarted the efforts of hygiene in Paris until finally the newspapers were able to persuade them what was actually going on. By that time, it had already spread to England, Spain, and Portugal. In June of 1832, we find it in Canada. Now, for the first time in the Western Hemisphere, it's come over with Irish immigrants. And part of the reason is because of the speed at which transportation is now operating. In the old days, and that's why the first epidemic never got to America, in the old days, once you got it, you died so rapidly that if you were on a boat to America, you would have been dead by then. And everybody else who would get the disease, by the time they got to America, would either be dead or have recovered from it and be immune.
Be safe.
So yeah. It was no longer contagious. Now that you have steamships, you can get from Ireland to Canada fast enough that you can end up with the symptoms, end up sick, or maybe even not sick yet with the symptoms, but land in Canada and then carry the disease. Two authors said the following about the unpreparedness of cities to defend their populations. Mm-hmm. And again, maybe we can learn something from this. It said this: crowded slums, limited and contaminated water supply, hopelessly ineffective methods of eliminating sewage and garbage, and city governments ill-equipped to deal with the explosive growth of populations. So this is in a book called Epidemics. It came out in 1976. And it's one of those books that you don't want to read it at night. You won't sleep. Their description describes St. Louis to the T in 1832. It was believed that cholera arrived in St. Louis with soldiers who had been fighting in the Black Hawk Wars. More soldiers and Indians died of this disease than on the battlefields.
Wow.
And so when these men were making their way back to Jefferson Barracks, they brought the disease with them. The cholera epidemic reappears then. Remember, it starts in October of 1832. By May of 1833, it's back again. And it continues killing all throughout the summer months. St. Louis University abandoned its campus. Down on Washington Avenue, they closed the campus entirely, and those who stayed went up to the Jesuit seminary in Florissant to get away from the city. In August, 60 people died in St. Charles alone. It's at this time also that Sister Amelia Ann, who is a sister of charity at Melanthe Hospital, died. There's a third wave of cholera that's forewarned to break out, and that is in December of 1848. And that's going to happen, first of all, in New Orleans. It breaks out in New Orleans. It's one of the worst cholera outbreaks in New Orleans, and is going to be part of their history.
This is 48?
This is 48,
okay. Yeah.
And the immigrants are going to carry it north, up the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers. The idea of quarantine was not even thought of at this time. Well, let's go back to 1842 and 3. The weekly tallies of cholera death begin on April 30th with 41 deaths. From June 18th to July 23rd, something along the lines of 400 people died each week in St. Louis.
Wow.
By the time it's over, 2,842 people died specifically because of cholera. Now, that's a big number in a city like St. Louis.
I was just going to say, what is our count at that point? What are we?
I'm guessing 70,000 at all.
70,000.
I think about 70,000. So we're looking at almost 3,000 of them dying from this one disease.
That is frightening.
Yeah. The public schools in St. Louis were all turned into hospitals. There were a number of Catholic institutions that did the same thing. Now the city government is convinced that it's being the disease is spread by fruit and vegetables. So now the city passes an ordinance forbidding the sale of all produce and mandated that people eat all meat meals.
Okay. So,
there's a body of doctors that argue that produce is healthier for you, And eventually they convinced the city to reverse itself. Now, this is going to be in the 1849 outbreak, but three doctors are going to die. Two Sisters of Charity are going to die. That hospital alone treated 1,330 cases of cholera alone. Wow. But to say something about the hygienic conditions of that hospital, 510 people died. 510 out of 1,330. So the mortality rate is under 50%.
Under 50.
Yeah, it's a little higher than 33%. So many people were orphaned in the city of St. Louis that City Hospital had to take them in. These are the orphans. They've lost both parents. The city council voted $1,000 in order to temporarily house them. Interestingly enough, Mayor Barry suggested that the money go to Archbishop Kenrick instead because the Catholics were better at dealing with this than the public sector was. They didn't do it, but it would have been a smart move. St. Louis saw the second largest devastation among all the American cities. Yeah, only New York actually lost more people than we did.
They had more to lose.
New York was seven times larger in population than St. Louis. So, you know, that just says something about that. And then, in the midst of this cholera epidemic, we have the Great Fire of 1849. Oh. 1849 was a terrible year to be in St. Louis. This starts on the evening of May 17th, and it starts at the riverfront. One of the steamboats down on the riverfront is the White Cloud, and it had just been painted. A coat of wet paint had been placed on it. Now, remember that the paint that's being used back in those days is highly combustible. The hope was that throughout the night, there was a strong wind coming out of the northeast. The hope was that the wind would then dry the paint faster than what would happen otherwise. Well, this strong wind coming out of the northeast ended up being a detriment because it's believed that there was another steamboat that was going up the river beyond St. Louis, and it was trying to make headway, and so it was belching out lots of smoke, but also because they were firing the boilers so hot that there was chunks of debris, fire belching out of the chimney. And fiery particles then were caught up by that wind that blew it down right on top of the White Cloud, which caught fire around 10 p.m., so now you've got a ship burning. Now, typically what would happen is if you had a boat burning, you would then untie it and set it out into the river, and it would burn in the river or something like
burn
that.
Burn and sink, hopefully.
Right, yeah. And that was the whole idea behind that. And so what happens then is that before they could do that, as they're in the process of trying to push it out into the river, but you're also pushing it against that strong northeastern wind, as you're pushing it out into the river, the boat next to it, the Edward Bates, also caught flames. And that ignited another boat, the Eudora. Now, what happens then is that the Edward Bates in particular, they got out into the river and hopefully into the current. However, that strong wind from the northeast took the Edward Bates and pushed it back into... Now remember, nobody's on that crew. Obviously, you've abandoned that boat. But now what happens is that the boat is being pushed by that northeastern wind, being pushed back into the riverfront.
Coming back. To,
yes. And what happens is that it hits boat after boat after boat as it's being carried downstream by the current and pushed into these boats by the wind. And so boat after boat after boat is being set on fire. And these are very highly combustible boats, as you can well imagine. In all, 13 boats were now blazing. On several of these, there were kegs of gunpowder. And this, of course, explodes. And that's going to send chunks of burning wood up in all directions, including onto the riverfront. Now, St. Louis did not have a dock system or a wharf system. Instead, what happened was that the boats pulled up nose first right onto the levee, and they literally would run aground, and then they would set down their gangplanks, and that's how you got on and off of these boats. And they would load goods and passengers that way. Same thing would be to unload. And so what happened was that at this particular time, the river was high, and therefore the levee was narrower. And so you had goods close to the boats.
They're sitting right at the edge.
Sitting right at the edge. And right beyond the goods, of course, are all these warehouses.
Oh.
So you can imagine what's going to happen now. So what's happening then is that you have these explosions, these chunks of fiery wood come onto the levee. And, of course, the goods that are on the levee are piled up higher and closer than what they would be otherwise. And, therefore, they begin to burn. In fact, at this particular moment, there happened to be 2,000 bales of hemp that were there. They were going to be loaded onto those boats to be sent down south the next day. Obviously, they all catch fire.
Quickly.
And, of course, there's going to be more fire spreading because of that wind onto now the warehouses that are there. Most tragic of all, those hemp bundles are so big. 4 people were actually sleeping on them that night, and the fire was so fast, all 4 of them were consumed before they could get off of those bales. Yeah.
That just shows how fast that
how
was
fast.
Moving.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because you'd have expected that there has to be a lot of commotion happening there at the moment.
Oh, yeah, really, yeah. Yeah, these guys must have been really sleeping tight.
Right.
Yeah. Most of a good portion of St. Louis, downtown St. Louis, is going to be destroyed. Interestingly enough and almost miraculously, the old cathedral is not. We'll talk about that next time.
That sounds good. Let's close it.
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you. In the name of the Father, Son.
Monsignor.
Okay.